Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, October 31st, 2016. South Sudanese church leaders say Pope Francis has agreed to pay a visit to South Sudan.
So if the Pope could come to South Sudan and pray for us, and if the South Sudanese could not listen to him, then who will they listen to? That's the reason we wanted him to come.
And the Committee to Protect Journalists places South Sudan near the top of its list of countries that allow impunity.
We're seeing journalists targeted not just for their work, not just to silence them from something they might be working on or reporting on, but targeted simply because they're journalists.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese church leaders who visited Pope Francis earlier this month say the Holy Father has accepted an invitation to visit South Sudan. The church leaders were in Rome last week to brief Vatican officials about South Sudan's security and humanitarian situation. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
The Archbishop of the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan, Right Reverend Daniel Deng Bull, who headed the delegation of the South Sudanese church leaders, told reporters upon arrival at Juba International Airport Sunday that he hopes the Pope's visit will bring peace, healing, and reconciliation to the country. Archbishop Deng says Pope Francis was deeply touched about the suffering of the South Sudanese people after hearing first-hand accounts from South Sudan's church leaders about the ongoing fighting and human rights abuses in the country. Archbishop Deng says the Holy Father immediately accepted an invitation by South Sudanese church leaders to come and bless South Sudan.
Actually, our president, when he met him in Kenya, have invited him. The Catholics have invited him. Now, all the churches in Juba, in South Sudan, we are inviting him. The reason is that he's a man of peace. We need him to come at least to pray in our land here. And with that, God may listen to his prayers and all of us.
The Vatican has yet to decide when Pope Francis will visit Juba. Archbishop Deng says he believes the pontiff's visit will boost efforts to restore peace in South Sudan.
If Pope come here, that is the last authority in the church. So if the Pope could come to South Sudan and pray for us, and if the South Sudanese could not listen to him, then who will they listen to? That's the reason we wanted him to come.
He says the Pope conveyed his appreciation for the role the church has played in efforts to restore peace in South Sudan and said it's important for South Sudanese to resist the rumors and hate speeches that could further divide the country.
We encourage our people. We encourage you not to lose hope. We encourage you to come together. We are one people. As a church, we need peace in our country. We are one people. We don't need people to be pragmatic. And with this, we pray with you, and God will bring peace to our country very soon.
The conflict erupted in late 2013, 2 years after independence from Sudan. The latest deadly fighting broke out in July in Juba, which left at least 300 people dead and tens of thousands of others displaced. A week later, Pope Francis sent a message of solidarity to President Salva Kiir and his rival former First Vice President Riek Machar through one of his top envoys, Cardinal Peter Kodwo-Turkson, who spent 2 days in Juba shortly after the fighting broke out. Vatican Radio reported in November last year that Pope Francis held a private 15-minute meeting with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir in Uganda's State House during the papal visit to Uganda in November 2015. The Holy See Press Office said the Pope's meeting with President Kiir was private. Chapter 5 of the Agreement to Resolve Conflict in South Sudan requires the Transitional Government of National Unity to establish a mechanism including using faith-based groups or church leaders to promote national reconciliation and healing in order to ensure lasting peace. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The Committee to Protect Journalists say 95% of the journalists murdered around the world over the last 10 years were local reporters. The CPJ says the culture of impunity is one of the biggest threats to freedom of press. Elizabeth Witchell, CPJ's researcher from London, spoke to South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayen Bure.
The situation is very dangerous, and it's more dangerous than ever, which is seeing a very, very different kinds of threats confronting journalists. You know, we're seeing journalists targeted not just for their work, not just to silence them from something they might be working on or reporting on, but targeted simply because they're journalists. We're seeing threats coming from so many different sides. It's not all governments arresting journalists or government soldiers or police attacking journalists. We're seeing criminal groups that have become very powerful targeting journalists in Mexico. We're seeing, as I said before, we're seeing extremist groups targeting journalists in war-torn areas. We're seeing political groups like in South Sudan targeting journalists.
And Somalia was ranked number one 2 years in a row. Was that surprising at all for you?
We were surprised last year when Somalia became number one because it surpassed Iraq, which has, without a doubt, just for so many years, had record numbers of journalists murdered and killed, and 99% of them with complete impunity. So for many years, Iraq was far and above the first one. And in Somalia, journalists have been killed year after year after year, and you never saw the huge surge that we used to see in Iraq in the 2005, 2006. But we have just seen a steady number of journalists killed and their killers not caught.
What does this report say about the global trend of impunity?
Out of the numbers of journalists that are murdered for their work, 90% of the cases that the killers get away with it. Between last year and this year, I would actually say we're seeing a few slight, very slight improvements, which is encouraging, but they are really, really very, very small.
How does targeting journalists affect society as a whole?
When there's no consequences for the perpetrator, it sends a very menacing message to the whole media community in that country. So you, of course, start to see, you might start seeing self-censorship. You just see it becoming harder and harder for the media to cover important issues. And then that, in turn, creates a huge information gap, whether it's, you know, an understanding of politics and conflict in Somalia and Iraq and Syria, or whether it's learning about being informed about corruption or crime in the Philippines or Mexico. You know, we're starting to see what is a very damaging information gap. It makes it very difficult for countries like South Sudan that need to build a functioning civil society.
That's Elizabeth Witchell, consultant for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She was speaking to VOA's Ayen Bure from London. Thousands of South Sudanese who fled to Uganda 20 years ago during the conflict between the Sudan People's Liberation Army and successive governments in Khartoum never returned home after the 2005 peace agreement, which ended decades of war. Reporter Simon Peter Piku spoke to some of the refugees at Kiriadongo who say Uganda is more than a home to them.
The 66,000 refugees at the Kiriadongo settlement include thousands who refused to be repatriated after the 2005 peace agreement. The refugees say they preferred to remain here because of insecurity and a lack of basic social services back home. Anthony Kenyi, who arrived at the Kiriadongo settlement in 1989, says he fled Sudan after he narrowly escaped death at the hands of Sudanese security forces. He says since then, he never again considered returning.
Every time when I was running out, they have killed my brother. So that was now taking my hope out to go back. I cannot even stay there because that village it's not okay to me. That is why I am here.
Kenyi left Sudan with two children and fathered five more while living in the settlement. He says two of his children later decided to settle in South Sudan. He regrets allowing them to live in the first place.
They decided to go back in southern Sudan. They leave me here. One was he got his job working with Sudan population. But you see, even the same thing happened to him. He was shot away by the government army in Torit. Secondly, another brother of him is even working with these UNIMIS in Torit. That was even in this 2014. National Security arrest this man. Until now, I don't know where he is now even. So this make me, I cannot go back.
Speaking in her native Mali language, Rose Akongo, a single mother of six who also left her country in 1989, defends her decision to remain in the refugee settlement.
I'm better off staying here because since I settled in the camp, the people have gone back to South Sudan and returned twice. Each time they found me here. Had I accepted to be repatriated after the 2005 peace agreement, I would now be returning here for the second or third time. That is why I have decided to remain here. I will return only after I'm sure that there is real peace in South Sudan.
Some refugees say that after settling in Uganda and spending nearly half of their lives in the settlement, they cannot imagine starting a new life in South Sudan. Agnes Pony came here in 1990. Now a mother of five, Pony says she married and gave birth to all of her children in the settlement. Uganda, she says, has become her new home.
I'm a widow. I lost my husband. I'm now almost 7 years without a man, but I'm struggling to take care of my children. Because if I go back also, need me to put another plan for constructing house and paying school fees, looking for food.
Refugees who arrived here in the mid-1980s to early 1990s do not receive food rations, but they still benefit from Uganda's favorable protection environment that allows refugees the right to work and earn a living.
When the food UNHCR stopped giving us food, first of all, in the settlement, they give us land. Used to dig, just you survive with your digging. That digging you do, you dig, you sell some others you feed with children, others you pay their school fees. That is how now we are staying here.
For many South Sudanese children in Uganda, the Kiria Dongo refugee settlement is the only home they have ever known. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Apiku in Kiria Dongo District, Uganda.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Have you tried foreign foods? If so, which did you like?
Yes, I've tried foreign foods. I've eaten pizzas and they are tasty. Actually, you found me Googling out how to make a homemade pizza. Yes, and I was trying to check out on different recipes so that I can also make one at home.
Okay, when I was in Kampala, I took that mochoke. I ate it because on Saturday, every Saturday, they used to make it at school. I even learned how to make it. It was very sweet.
Yes, I like club sandwich. It comes with potato chips as well. It's very, very nice.
Foreign foods. I don't think I have because I like the Ghanaian dishes. For example, jollof rice with goat meat.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A new study by the United Nations Development Programme and the Sudan National Commission for Countering Violent Extremism says terrorism could become a serious threat in Sudan. The report says Sudan's location and its high rate of poverty and unemployment make it vulnerable to violent radicalism. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Khartoum.
Preliminary results of the UNDP study were released at an event over the weekend in Khartoum. The study was conducted through interviews with families in Khartoum affected by violent extremism, as well as individuals who have been involved in extremist activities in the past. UNDP Country Director in Sudan, Selva Ramachandran, says UNDP is still conducting interviews across the country.
Our aim is to complete the study by early next year. And the reason we are doing is also to respond to the findings that we will have from a programmatic angle. And for that purpose, implementation of any program cannot happen without support and participation of all of you.
Ramachandran says the government can counter religious extremism by creating job opportunities for young people and working with moderate Muslim imams to fight radical religious propaganda. Marta Reuters is the UN resident coordinator, a UNDP resident representative in Sudan. Reuters says violent extremism in Sudan will have consequences that extend across the region and beyond.
It requires strong partnerships among all stakeholders and all affected parties in order to properly address the threat. One which, moreover, is not only limited to security, but has the potential to derail stability and the development processes across the region.
Reuters says the UN is committed to working with Sudanese youth to help them become positive agents of change.
Nobody is born a terrorist, and we therefore must identify and address the underlying drivers of violent extremism so that the youth that is at risk can become part of the solution rather than the problem itself. The Sustainable Development Goals have highlighted that youth have a crucial role for sustainability and need to be given space and opportunities to develop and to contribute to positive change.
Salahuddin bin Dawood is the Canadian ambassador to Sudan. He says his country has also been tested by religious extremism. Bin Dawood says his government stands ready to help Sudan fight extremism.
We look forward to engaging with all partners once the outcomes of the study are made available. We hope to work with Sudanese partners in the coming months to share Canadian experiences on preventing violent extremism.
Religious extremism and religious violence have been reported in Sudan on numerous occasions. Critics of the Sudanese government say the ideology of the ruling National Congress Party supports extremism. The government denies the accusations and says it is working to end extremism in Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biaju.
The United Nations Population Fund warns that forced marriages, child labor and female genital mutilation can jeopardize girls' health and their rights. The United Nations and government officials released the 2016 State of World Population Report in Juba today, which focuses on 10-year-old girls. Michael Atit has the story for VOA from Juba.
Ten-year-old schoolgirls sing songs at the launch of the UN-Fund Population Report, which include a panel discussion about challenges facing 10-year-old South Sudanese girls. 10-year-old Rachel Idris is in Primary 5 in Juba at Bright Bomaistar Primary School. Rachel says she worries about her future because of the ongoing fighting in South Sudan. She says she dreams of becoming a lawyer so she can defend girls' rights in her community.
Here in our country, there are boys that we call them that teens. They may rape us, and every day we are hearing gunshot, so that it makes me to fear.
Another 10-year-old girl, Mary Adieu, is also a primary 5 at the same school. She says her dream is to become a doctor, but she says she worries about the deteriorating economic situation in South Sudan and the impact it will have on her parents.
Because the number of doctors and nurses are very, very low. And that's why I'm just studying to become a doctor to help my members and my colleagues around me.
Both Idris and Adieu are calling on the government to ensure that girls at their age can study in a safe environment so they can complete school and participate in building South Sudan's future. Matthew Nyajong, a father of two, participated in today's launch. Nyajong says parents need to be nurturing their children all the time so they don't end up seeking support from strangers who might do them harm.
The only reason why I was doing this is because I know at that age, when they are not free with me, they would approach people who will misadvise them. And therefore, I was stopping that misadvice so that they don't get wrong advices from people, but they come to me in a free atmosphere so that I advise them rightly.
The 2016 State of the World Population Report says of the 125 million 10-year-olds today, 60 million are girls who are systematically disadvantaged at the global level as they move from adolescence into adulthood. As parents, Fandira is the UNFPA country representative for South Sudan. Fandira says the UNFPA 2016 State of the World Population Report indicates that bad practices against young girls begin at the age of 10. She says in many countries around the world, including South Sudan, girls are not given opportunities to pursue their dreams due to cultural norms.
Whenever a girl cannot realize her full potential in life, she suffers an unforgivable injustice and a violation of her fundamental rights. When a girl enjoys her rights, is able to stay in school, stay healthy, and be protected from child marriage and early pregnancy, her full potential may be realized by the time she reaches adulthood. She will be better equipped to find a job, earn a good wage, and seize opportunities as they arise.
Rachel Nyadak-Paul is President Salva Kiir's advisor on gender and human rights issues. She admits that many 10-year-old girls in South Sudan suffer from sexual exploitation and child labor. Nyadak says the government is committed to developing policies that ban such practices.
In South Sudan, the condition of the 10-year girls in deplorable social and cultural beliefs drive this practice of earlier marriage, teenager pregnancy, school dropout, and sexual gender-based violence. The conditions is worsened with ongoing crisis where the 10-year-old has to drop out of his schools.
Nyadak also says she is aware that parents in many communities across the country start to book future wives for their children when they are as young as 7 to 10 years old. She says more than a third of South Sudanese girls between the ages of 15 and 19 are already mothers. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Ethiopia's state-backed news agency reports that about 2,000 people detained during recent protests have been released after receiving what the government called education and counseling services. Marta Vandewoff looked into this practice of rehabilitation for opposition sympathizers and has this report for VOA from Brussels.
According to the Fana Broadcasting Network, Ethiopia's Minister of Defense, Siraj Fegesa, told reporters that rehabilitation services for about 2,000 people detained over recent violence have concluded and those people have been released. Government spokesman Getachew Reda told reporters last week that the rehabilitation programs help the government deal with the large amount of people in detention.
Probably this is the only government in the world that meets out punishment in the form of constitution classes. So, I mean, some fitness exercise, maybe. It's only the most dangerous criminals will have to face the consequences really seriously. Otherwise, it's going to be rehabilitation programs. In 3 weeks, a month, you teach them constitutions. You teach them some values and ABCs of basic decency, if you will.
But international human rights groups have a different take. Human Rights Watch said in a statement Monday that rehabilitation is a euphemism for short-term detention and that these programs typically involve ill treatment and sometimes torture. Human Rights Watch says there is no due process or formal record of these detentions. The rights group says tens of thousands of people have been detained since anti-government protests began in November 2015. A deadly stampede and violent attacks on government buildings and foreign businesses prompted the declaration of a 6-month state of emergency October 9th. There are no independently verified reports on exactly how many people have been detained since then. Opposition leader Merera Gudina of the Oromo People's Congress says hundreds of his party members have been arrested.
Mostly they don't have legal advice, lawyers and so on. And in fact, sometimes we don't know where they are detained. And it's not normal prison, you know. It's simply they are, for example, in Shashamane area, I heard that they were detained in cinema house. So they're detained anywhere, you know.
The protests started in the Oromia region last year over a plan to expand the capital city, but have since expanded to other parts of the country and to include issues of economic marginalization and political freedom. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Brussels.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Pope Francis has agreed to visit South Sudan. A date is yet to be set by the Vatican. A delegation of church leaders visited the pontiff at the Vatican last week to describe the deteriorating humanitarian conditions in the country. Archbishop Daniel Deng says Pope Francis is deeply concerned about the level of suffering of the South Sudanese people after hearing firsthand accounts from the church leaders about the ongoing fighting there and human rights abuses in the country. Chapter 5 of the agreement to resolve the conflict in South Sudan requires that the transitional government of national unity establish a mechanism, including using faith-based groups or church leaders, to promote national reconciliation. The Committee to Protect Journalists says 95% of the journalists murdered around the world over the last 10 years were local reporters, yet many of those responsible have gone unpunished. Elizabeth Witchell, the author of the report, says such impunity is one of the biggest threats to freedom of the press. The committee and Witchell says South Sudan is one of the top five countries where abuses against journalists are committed. And finally, thousands of South Sudanese who fled to Uganda 20 years ago during the conflict between the Sudan People's Liberation Army and successive governments in Khartoum never returned home after the 2005 peace agreement was signed, which ended decades of war. The 66,000 refugees at the Kiradongo settlement include thousands who refused to be repatriated. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with a peace song by Sarah Nyapal.
I call on the Sudanese people to join this peace agreement, to join the SPLM and the National Congress Party in the peace process, because this peace agreement belongs to them. It does not belong to John Garang or the SPLM leadership. It does not belong to Ali Ousmane Taha or President Bashir or to the National Congress Party. This agreement belongs to all of the Sudan, to its neighbors, to Africa, to the Arab world, and indeed to the rest of the world.
We've been listening to Sarah Nyapal with that peace song. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for tuning into the show. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.